This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
1,000 million kalpas, having to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's great to see you. So I feel like I should offer a disclaimer. I'm about to recite a koan from the Blue Cliff Record, but the problem with this koan for me is that a number of years ago, my wife and I spent a bunch of time watching the kind of reboot of Battlestar Galactica. And one of the things that was striking to me about the writing in it was that it had a lot of stuff that smelled, you know, kind of vaguely Buddhist or something like that. And I don't have any idea why, and I never looked into it. But this was one of the most peculiar tropes in the whole thing. There was a repeated exchange in it where people would say to each other, usually, Adama, played by Edward James Olmos, would say to Starbuck, played by Katie Sackhoff, what do you hear? And she'd say, nothing but the rain. And then he'd say, go get your rifle and bring in the cat. What? What are you talking about? So this koan basically is, it's so similar that it's hard to believe that somebody in the department didn't at least read it once. And so I can't possibly think about this koan without imagining that it's an exchange between, you know, Jing Ching, played by Edward James Olmos, and a monk, played by Katie Sackhoff. And usually I imagine they meet in one of these covered walkways, you know, in the kind of near the gate of the temple, and they meet and they bow. And then the abbot thinks, I'll test out what's going on here. So he asks her, what do you hear? And she says, just the rain. And he says, you know, people are upside down. They lose themselves and they follow after things. And the monk says, how about you, teacher? Good answer. And Ching Ching says, I almost don't lose myself. And Katie Sackhoff says, what do you mean? And he says, you know, it should be easy to talk about this, but to talk about the whole thing, it's very difficult. So, you know, it's Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving. You know, post-Thanksgiving, everyone. One of the persistent features these days of Thanksgiving is that there's a constant flood of posts on all the social media you can imagine, plus people sending out emails, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Expressing their thanks, right? Marvelous. I'm thankful for X, my family, my job, my health, the love of my life, etc. Right? even a friend of mine who is now in the second round of chemotherapy for this disease that's in the end probably going to kill her, right? Did a thing where every day of the month up to Thanksgiving, she posted this really kind of beautiful, heartfelt snippet about what she was thankful for. Ah, so great. And yet, we all know what the problem with this sort of thing is, right? It's just a kind of, it's an aspect, it's a you know, laudable and deeply moving sometimes, but it's an aspect of the activity of self-construction that we all go through in order to put together a self that's capable of walking out the door and walking down the street without bumping into things, right? Because of how we are and who we are, right? Because we're human, because we're this one, we have a there's this constant narrative development going on, right? Mm. We can watch it if we pay attention. Maybe when you're sitting, right? Just watch what happens. That's if you teach people to meditate. So I've been doing a lot of this for the course of the last few years because I've been doing these workshops, right? Where bring in a group of people who maybe have done a little meditating, maybe haven't, but are really interested in sort of building a regular meditation practice in their lives because they've heard, not surprisingly, that it's helpful, right? So they come in and not the first thing they say about it maybe, but easily the second thing they say about it is, I had no idea that I was thinking so hard all the time and that it was so repetitious, emotionally charged, incredibly persistent, and almost inescapable in nature, right? Really, it's just a, and we're doing this all the time. It's how we are. We are building a self, right? We tell ourselves these stories about ourselves, right? Some of them are future-oriented stories. We reach forward into the future and we build this picture of what the future is going to be like. We construct a narrative out of it, and it's a peculiar kind of thing where it's almost like we're looking at future time T, we're looking at it from future time T plus something, and we're thinking back and thinking, that's how it was. Awesome, right? And we do the same thing with the past. It's the same capacity. We look back into the past and take even our most difficult, problematic moments and kind of work on them, you know. Maybe I was right. maybe I didn't behave so badly. Maybe it was the right thing. So we do that. And then the other thing we do is we tell stories about who we are and how we are, right? And some of them are aspirational and positive, right? For my own life, just one example, I was raised up in the 50s and early 60s kind of, and that was an era where it was the last glorious gasp of techno-modernism. Like, we were the the kind of ruling narrative of the in the culture, in some ways, at least for me, in the part of it that I was in, if you took aside all the stuff about, you know, fighting with the Russians and so on, the ruling narrative was that we were going to deliver ourselves from the human condition by our marvelous, by the scientific method, I guess, right? We were going to develop science and technology that would make life look like it did on Star Trek, to be perfectly honest, right? Enlightened, multicultural world in which, or maybe multiracial, unicultural world, in which nobody wanted for anything, right? You could just go to a machine, push a button, and get a perfectly made Earl Grey tea. Whoa. And everything else, right? And where human health was a non-issue for the most part. Unless you were wearing the wrong uniform, in which case you'd walk out the door of the Enterprise and be zapped within, you know, 10 minutes of, the next commercial break, basically, and you were gone. But for the most part, human health was a non-issue. Leaving aside how all that worked out, right? What that implanted in me was this notion that my life and worth was going to be defined by my ability to work brilliantly in the world of technology and build, you know, beautiful things, right? Build beautiful, complicated, effective things. And so, of course, I went to work with a whole bunch of people that had the same idea. And what happens when you do that? You get a whole bunch of people fighting over ideas. Right? And my whole career as an engineer has been a deep, personal, sometimes incredibly difficult exploration of the dynamics that arise out of that, right? Just because of how I am and how I define myself, right? So I do a project, I think, wonderful, right? I feel a kind of balloon of self-esteem inflate somewhere in my chest, right? And it, you know, hangs around for a while, and then something bad happens, and you can almost feel it, like somebody, it's not like the balloon goes away right away, it kind of, somebody just unties the little knot in the inflating spout of the balloon, and the air slowly leaks out, and that space is filled with some kind of poison, right? Maybe not so good. Maybe worthless and fraudulent, right? Maybe I should get out while the getting's good. That's the problem with losing the self and following after things, right? It's funny that he says losing the self, right? It's a because the kind of standard way of thinking about this activity, this self-narration, this kind of self-production, literally, is that that we're building up what we normally conventionally think of as the self. But he's talking about something different. He's talking about a take on the self that's broader and more that's both more inclusive and utterly empty, right? When he asks the question, "What do you hear? What do you hear outside the gate?" Already, he's kind of set a trap, right? It's like, what's outside the gate? what's this one who hears, right? What is it to ask, what do you hear? It's a deep question, right? And if you answer it honestly, great. I hear the sound of rain, just the sound of rain. If you completely duck the question, probably not such a good idea. That's not what he was asking for. But there's something else going on there too. If you really sit quietly and listen to the sound of rain, right? Something remarkable happens, right? We have this idea, the sound of rain, right? And what we think when we think the sound of rain is shh, or maybe some kind of shh, right? Something like that, right? That was a terrible imitation of the sound of rain. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Actually, it's not like that at all. If you really listen to the sound of rain, it's a infinite variety of individual sounds all combined together, and you can hear up to your capacity to really listen. You can hear as many of them are as there are stars in the sky, right? Amazing, right? To sit and listen to the sound of rain. It's like the sound of rain is the whole world, right? And the question is, which part of that is inside and which part is outside, right? Where do you draw the line? Your body is just a little knot in the midst of this vast process that we call the living world, right? Who says that that me stops at my skin? It's only a matter of convenience, right? It's only a matter of what makes it more likely that we're going to be able to walk down the street without bumping into things, and that we'll be able to stay alive by executing the agendas that we see as beneficial, right? That's okay, but we all know how it leads to difficulty, to compared to the vast, overwhelming array of difficulty that particular thing has led to. Simply a lifetime of arguing over ideas is a drop in the bucket, literally, one raindrop, right? The just think of the world and think of the way in which this clinging to self, this clinging to losing the self and following after things, right? Losing big mind, grasping to small mind, entangling with things, entangling with other people, and then just going to town with that has just made a terrible mess, right? And we continue to make a mess. So, and you know, because we're all sitting here in a zendo, it's worth mentioning that the solution to this problem that we're all working on was defined by the founder of Japanese Soto Zen as studying the self, right? So that's what he says. He says, just sit down and watch the arising of the self. Become as intimate and diligent, as forthright and as compassionate with it as you can possibly muster in this moment, and then this moment, and then this moment. And the compassion is crucial, because I think it was, it's usually attributed to Bismarck, right? But he made some remark about how politics and sausage making are things where you'd better not to know the details. You know, self-construction is also like that, right? It operates most effectively out of sight, and when you really shine the light on it, when you, like Dogen says, take the backward step that illuminates the self, right? It's good to be ready for anything and to bring along your most compassionate, non-judgmental, and curious mind. Right? So just to study the self in that way. And then he says, something happens, right? To study the self in that way is to forget the self, right? The self by itself, the notion of this body, the notion of this mind, the notion of this separate self, drops away. It doesn't do it because we struggle with it, because we wrestle to the ground and pin it until it fades. It's because it does it of its own accord, right? Because when we really dig in and become intimate and watch it moment after moment, the binding energy that holds it together just lets go. It lets go regularly, but it lets go in particular in that setting, right? When we practice with it, right? And something else comes up. It's not that it ever goes away, right? Ching Ching doesn't say, I don't lose myself, right? He says, I almost don't lose myself. Our body is host to, and mind is host to, these two kinds of modes of being, right? There's a mode of being that experiences the world in this way that's remarkably unconstructed, right? And doesn't need to categorize things too deeply, that doesn't need to wrangle over them, and that doesn't play this game of narrative construction, right? And then there's what we conventionally call the self. And they live together, right? And according to the sort of Mahayana story of the awakening of the Buddha, that's what he says. He says, look, I get it. We have the mind of awakening, and at the same time, because of our preoccupations, of our self-preoccupation, right, we don't really realize it. We don't see it very often. We see it, but not very often, and not very clearly. It's hazy. And the practice of practice is to explore exactly that dynamic. This kind of radiant, unconstructed awareness, the kind of gravity and energy, attention required by the constructed self to keep building itself and not let go, right? And our attention can kind of cycle between those things, neither abiding in non-thinking nor in thinking, just to let it flow one way and back, and to observe that, right? In the long run, over time, what starts to be true is that they're both present, right? It's not that we lose this, right? It's not that we're always living over here in the unconstructed. At that point, there'd be no way we could get up and walk down the street without bumping into things. We'd be, I've been in the midst of this kind of complicated email correspondence with a guy who writes a book. He's a comes from a different school of Buddhism, but he wrote a book where he says, you know, be careful when you get to the mode where you see objects as insubstantial, realize that they're still substantial. don't walk into any trees or that sort of thing, right? It's not, you're still going to bonk your head, but yeah, exactly. So here's a question. Does anyone have any questions as long as we're here? And does anyone have a watch so I know what time it is?
It's 10 to 11.
Perfect. Does anyone have any questions? Go ahead.
How often do you sit?
Well, every weekday morning and a bunch on Saturdays, because I run a Zazen Kai group over in North Beach, and I spend most mornings at most Saturday mornings at San Francisco City Center, and I also run a sitting group in the Tenderloin on Fridays. So that's the sort of baseline. And then starting tomorrow, I'm going to be sitting pretty much all day for a week. Doing a sesshin, so that's a pretty intensive schedule. But Can I ask what underlies the question? How often?
Just my struggle to establish a consistent sitting. And that's basically what you were talking about, was sitting, I felt.
Yeah.
What goes on. I found it helpful because I realized I totally don't have compassion for myself when I sit.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
at all.
Yeah. It's so hard, right? I mean, that's what Suzuki Roshi is saying at the beginning of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He's saying, There's a general idea that Zen meditation is hard, but it's not totally clear why it's hard. And he says, it's not hard because it's hard to sit, right? I mean, some people find sitting in a cross-legged position difficult, so pick another position, right? There are some logistical aspects, right? You have to set aside some time to do it, but logistics is the art of the possible, according to some guy, military guy. but he says, and it's not even really all that hard to get enlightened, right? What he says, what's really hard is that we tangle up the self, this self, our judgmental, agenda executing, goal seeking self, with our activity of practice. We tangle it up with everything. It's because we're human, right? It's what humans do. And that can be tremendously difficult. It can mean that our sitting feels like a kind of a wrestling match, right? And everybody has that experience. It's universal as far as I can tell, right? The kind of immediate antidote for it is just kind of a yoga, right? Just to bring the attention to the body and bring the attention to the breath, right? It's okay that there's thoughts going on, but just to on the out-breath, to watch the out-breath fall into the belly and then pause there, right? and let the breath come in by itself. There's a moment in that pause in which the tension, both mental and physical, that's inherent, that was inherent in the last moment, can kind of collapse along with the breath into the belly and let go, right? Just to do that, and kind of to do it over and over and over again, right? As often as we need to do it, right? Just to do the simple yoga of practice, and let the self come forth. Yeah. But it's a difficult thing. And like I said, everyone does it. Yeah.
The word in my language for human is kon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the same word used for mixed up.
Nice, that's wonderful.
Yeah, to be human is to be mixed up.
Yeah.
It's the same word. Kon means just mix it all up, tangled.
Yeah.
The word tangled, the word mixed up is the same word as kon. And it's meant to be the same.
That's marvelous, right? There's this great guy, I think I've actually already talked about him in here.
No.
Yeah. That his name is Ian Hodder, and he runs the dig at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which is a very, very, very old city or town or something. Nobody's really sure what it was actually, but it was heavily inhabited roughly 9,000 years ago, or maybe a little later, right? And he wrote a book about it, which is pretty dry, but every now and again he gets into the good stuff, and he says something like this. It's somewhere in the middle of the book, all of a sudden he just launches into this thing, and he says, you know, if you look at the history of human culture since the Paleolithic, what you see is an increasing elaboration of entanglement between people and an entanglement between people and things. That's what he says. He says it's the human story since the beginning, right? And if you look at it, we're still doing it. Right? We invented a whole set of technologies that makes it more possible at the drop of a hat for us to get entangled with everything, right? Amazing. But yes, absolutely, that's marvelous. And it's great that that it comes built into the language.
Yeah, my father's no help. If I go to him and I said, I'm confused, you know, I'm thinking this, but I'm thinking this, and that's happened, and she said, well, you're a con.
Right.
Like, okay.
Ah, wonderful. So here's a question. How do you practice with that? What do you do about that?
Oh, it's tough. It's
yeah.
tough. Because if you really get to it, and you see it, and you see the confusion,
mm-hmm.
and if it's, you know, if that's, and the construction of the self is stripped away, you have nothing to hang on to.
Yeah, exactly.
So you take away all the confusion, you're left with something pretty, I think it's pretty devastating.
Right. Well, here's the good news, right? And this was the sort of, you know, great segue. This is the kind of the going to be the last 30 seconds of my talk, right? So the alternative to being thankful for something is to be thankful for nothing, right? And that sounds glib. But in fact, it's not like that at all, right? So my experience with this is that, yeah, it's difficult to let go, right? But when we do let go, and that's the whole practice of practice is, you could argue that it's a continuous series of presentations of opportunities, moment after moment, in which we could let go, right? Particularly these retreats, sesshins, right? If you don't let go, like on the first day of a sesshin, you just struggle until you actually do let go, right? And so it's difficult, and there's a great deal of concern that if we do drop it, something terrible is going to happen. You know, like I know for me, that whole, the whole dynamic for me around ideas and self-worth and so on and so forth, my escape valve was always like, I'd rather run out the door and never come back than let go of this particular part of myself, because it feels so central and crucial to everything, right? This little balloon of self-esteem that inflates itself and deflates itself in my heart, right? But as it turns out, when we do let go and we let this other mode of being develop and kind of seep into our everyday life, some other thing happens. There's this kind of sense of standing solidly on the ground, right? Ah. And holding up the sky with your head, right? There's a kind of sense that there's this spring in your belly that ideas just come out of, right? When the question comes up, the response comes up at the same time. It's not so bad, right? So just to work with that and let the opportunity present itself compassionately and completely let go, and then just watch what happens, right? The good news about doing this on the cushion is that we're not running around in traffic or in the middle of a conversation with somebody where we could, you know, make a terrible mistake or anything like that. We're just sitting here staring at a wall, right? So we practice it here, sitting here staring at a wall, and then slowly it kind of leaks into our everyday life, right? And all of a sudden, the world is a very different place. So, anyone else?
The juncture at which you say, like in practice, where we find ourselves in past stories or future stories, the narratives, and then you say, like, let go. To me, that word, I mean, it's like, maybe you can unpack it just a little bit more, because when you say let go.
Yeah.
For me, there's kind of a sense sometimes at that moment when I catch myself, like in a future thing, there's like a nanosecond where I let go, but it doesn't have to be like, oh, I wasn't present, I was thinking in the future. And it involves someone I have difficulty with, or I'm very close with, for a second I can sometimes feel it's like a wish for them.
Yeah.
Not like I shouldn't be doing that, it's in the future, I shouldn't be thinking about something in the past.
Yeah, it's not a matter of shouldn't, right?
Yeah, right. So
there's one to let go,
where you said it was almost like a gear shifting thing, and I couldn't quite.
Yeah, so again, it's mostly a kind of a yoga, right? So to. This remarkable thing happens where we're caught up in thought. The thing that really makes us caught up in thought is to have a powerful emotional underpinning to the whatever thoughts that we're having, right? So often those moments where we're really tied up in thought are deeply emotional and sometimes physical if the emotions are strong enough, right? So we feel this. Miraculously, for some reason, right? And the reasons are always mysterious. Sometimes it's literally just because all of a sudden my knee hurts or something like that. We notice, here I am, right? We don't have to fight or struggle with anything, just to bring the attention and the self here completely. Often what happens is that whatever train of thought we were following sort of frays and disappears if we do that. Not always, actually, but often it does. But to really explore while that's happening what it feels like. What's the emotional underpinning of this thought? What's the What's the power in this story for me? How does it make this human life, how does it animate this human life, right? That's a way to both honor that, the power of that story, and to be here with it as completely as possible, right? And it's a way of practicing this mode that's the heart of practice, which is just to reconnect with the mode of being that is completely human, right? It's not a should thing. It's a way of meeting the self and the preoccupations of the self completely and diligently and compassionately, is what I'd say. You know. Any other questions? Great.
You touched on the concept of the unconstructed and the constructed,
yeah,
the way we live in two,
yeah,
worlds, and I'm wondering, how do you deal with, I guess, the pitfall of like a sort of nihilism once,
yeah,
you sort of kind of come into contact with the unconstructed?
Yeah. Well, here's how that's been for me, right? For years, I would have these sort of significant experiences of kind of the dissolution of the self and usually in retreats and stuff like that. And then I'd spend month after month wrangling with myself. Why isn't this period of Zazen like that one? Okay, why isn't this period of Zazen like that one? And finally, it just tired me out, to tell you God's honest truth, right? You know, I was just like, I just should not be doing this anymore. It really, as a response to what was actually happening, it kind of wore itself out, right? That's just me kind of being kind of stubborn and graspy and human. But the other aspect of it is this, right? If the Buddha had said, hey, life is suffering. Suffering arises from self-clinging and this grasping and aversion, and there's a way out, and the way out is not to feel anything. Everyone would have said, "Get out of here," and the Buddhism would have died on the vine, right? We don't want to be inhuman, right? And we don't want to be, at least in this world, we don't want to, all board ourselves up in caves and spend the rest of our lives pursuing ever deeper dropping off of the mind and body, right? It's okay, but we're here in the world, right? And Buddhism as a kind of enterprise, in some way, it seems to me, if we're really talking about relieving the suffering of all beings, then what's important is to be here in the world, right? And so my personal experience of it has been that that being able to be completely human, to live a life that's completely human, that includes both modes of being and includes our capacity to kind of network with each other in this way where we learn how each other is just by feeling the air and watching people's bodies move around and hearing vocal inflection and so on and so forth, all of that, it's a constant kind of revelation and marvel, right? Why would I want to live any other way, right? And why would I not just want to get closer and closer to that, right? As opposed to running all the way down one side of the continuum and you know, spending my whole life staring at a wall. Right? Anyway, that's just me, but that's how it is for me. So. Well, we should probably call it a day, I think.
Our intention is equally extend to every being and place with the true.